Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You know, so much of our news that we normally report on year in, year out has been covered up, or overshadowed, I guess is a good word for it, by the, seems like, daily gyrations from Washington that we cover in our news because it is important as well. This hour, we get a chance to go back to looking at some of the Supreme Court decisions that have been handed down within the past few weeks that have a bearing on our life. Very interesting stories. We like to do this a couple times a year. Todd Pettis is with us of the University of Iowa Law School, where he's the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation. Hi, Todd.
Hi. It's great to see you.
Great to see you. Tony Goggin with us, Professor of Law at Drake University Law School in our Des Moines studio. Tony, great to have you on board.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, Ben.
So many of these stories, well, a few of them have been in our headlines, scant reporting in depth on these. And this is what we want to do this hour, to talk about a number. Have you walk us through really the stories behind these cases and the implications of the decisions in the high court later in the hour, perhaps through the hour? I have the feeling Tony and Todd will be getting a sense of how the newest U.S. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch is shaping the court. And, of course, at this time of year, it's another edition of Retirement Watch. I'll ask you, Tony and Todd, about that. Of course, big implications. It should another Supreme Court justice retire. But let's start off with our cases. We have plenty on our docket. And let me start with you, Todd. I put that front and center starting off this, introducing this show. Social media has been ruled to be a constitutional right in a unanimous decision. How so?
Yeah, it's an important little case, and kind of a simple little case too. It's a case called Packingham versus North Carolina. It involves a gentleman named Lester Packingham, but it was Lester Packingham Jr., so his nickname was J.R., so I'll refer to him as J.R. About 7 years ago, he gets a traffic ticket, and then the traffic ticket gets dismissed. You know, so you say, hallelujah. And hallelujah is actually about what he said. He went on Facebook, and I'll read to you what he posted.
All right.
Okay. This post leads to a criminal conviction and a case in front of the United States Supreme Court. But here's what he says after his traffic ticket gets dismissed. Man, God is good. How about I got so much favor they dismissed the ticket before court even started? No fine, no court costs, no nothing spent. Praise be to God. Wow. Thanks, Jesus. Well, that leads to a criminal conviction. And the reason why is that North Carolina has a law that says that if you are a registered sex offender, which J.R. was, dating back to when he was 21 and convicted of indecent liberties with a minor, if you're a convicted sex offender, you cannot access commercial social networking sites, which they defined as any kind of a website where people can put up a personal profile, like photos or personal information.
Facebook, Twitter, Facebook, any chat rooms or anything like that?
Exactly. And it may be, depending on how you read the statute, even things like Amazon, LinkedIn certainly. But there was some debate in the margins about just how far this went. But it certainly included Facebook.
Specific to North Carolina, not here in Iowa.
It was a North Carolina statute. Mm-hmm. That's right. And what North Carolina was trying to do, of course, was prevent registered sex offenders from, you know, being able to use the internet to locate children, find out information about them, and then begin to try to lure them in or something. Facebook itself, by the way, I didn't know this till reading this case, but Facebook itself, if you look at their terms of service, Facebook has as a term of service that you will not use Facebook if you are a registered sex offender.
Hmm.
They have a bunch of them. If you're under 13, you're not supposed to have a site and so forth. But so a North Carolina police officer is assigned the task of just kind of going through Facebook and looking for a registered sex offender, and he comes upon JR's post. So he's tried, and a jury convicts him. Now, the court, as you said in teeing this up, the court unanimously found that this was a violation of JR's freedom of speech. Under the First Amendment, of course, we have the right to free speech. This violated his right. All the Justice Gorsuch didn't participate. He joined the court a little too late to be in on this one. But they were still 8-0 agreeing that this statute went too broad. It's got a great purpose, trying to protect minors, but it's going way too broad to say you can't access any social media site mm-hmm. where there's personal profiles, that's too much.
Mm-hmm. Just curious, can you take away someone's freedom of speech with any crime?
Whenever you take away freedom of speech, we want to look at the circumstances in which it's happening, but you always ask, what's the government's purpose? And then is this way of achieving that purpose sufficiently tailored or targeted enough? And
This was too broad.
This was too broad. And so some of the justices said in one of the opinions, you know, if a state wants to say, you know, a commercial social networking site that really caters to minors, and then you wanted to tell registered sex offenders you can't access this particular site, that might be okay. One of the things that's interesting about this case is that the justices, even though unanimous, all eight of them agreeing that this was a violation of his First Amendment rights, they split 4-4 on what it would mean in this case to be cautious in dealing with what was here, one of their first cases dealing with the freedom of speech on the internet. It's kind of remarkable. We've had the internet so long, but this really is one of the first cases, maybe the first case, where the court's looking specifically at what can the government do to regulate the internet specifically when it comes to speech. And they all said we need to be cautious, but it meant two different things to them. I'll just tell you real briefly.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy plus the four Democratic appointees on the court, they said we need to be cautious, yes, and here's what we mean by that. We're still coming to grips with the internet revolution. It has totally changed the way we live, and we're still finding out how it's changing the way we live. And the way now to make for a person to make his or her voice heard is to go online.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be you'd go to a street or a park. You know, you physically go to where the people are and you stand up on a soapbox. Now you go online. And so what we need to be cautious as a court is saying anything that's going to be pretty quickly outmoded by the pace and the scope of this internet revolution.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining justices, the conservatives on the court, said we need to be cautious, and we're very nervous when you start talking about the internet being like a street or a park or something. There's peculiar things about the internet that make it a dangerous place, and we should not tie government's hands, certainly at this point, in being able to regulate what happens there.
Mm-hmm. So the first in the case, it sounds like, by the way you're setting this up, we'll have more cases in the future as our technology progresses and our ways of communicating become I don't know, stranger.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I mean, for example, you know, these social media sites, they say, well, it's not like a street or park. The conservatives said it's a much more dangerous place. Parents can't monitor the contacts. Yeah. There aren't live witnesses and so forth. So we will undoubtedly have another case, and it'll be prompted by state legislatures somewhere responding to this case and trying to tailor the law a bit more.
Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa Law School, if you just joined us, along with Tony Goggin of Drake University's Law School. We're going through some of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions handed down recently, what they've had on their docket this session, the stories behind the cases, the arguments, the implications. And I want to go to you, Tony, now for a ruling that I at least didn't hear much about. This is an 8-0 ruling before Judge Gorsuch had joined the bench evidently from March. That has implications for millions of American students with disabilities.
That's exactly right, Ben. You're referring to the case of Andrew v. Douglas County School District. And this was a case that arose from the federal law that governs how children with disabilities should be provided an education. The plaintiff in this case was a child with autism who had been enrolled in a public school in Colorado. Under federal law, a child with autism is protected by a law called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And it provides that children with disabilities must be provided a free, appropriate public education. The key word there is appropriate. In order to comply with the law, public schools must provide disabled children with a special education and related services in conformity with the child's, and here's another acronym, IEP, Individualized Education Program. And I think many of your listeners, certainly those in the public schools, will be familiar with the IEP procedure. An IEP is something that must be drafted that considers each individual child's circumstances and must be tailored to the unique needs of each child each school year when the child is covered by the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The issue in this case was the fact that the parents were very unhappy with the quality of instruction that their child had been provided. And they believed that the school district had not complied with the federal law, and they demanded reimbursement for the tuition they had had to pay when they took the child out of the public schools and enrolled him in the private – in a local private school. And the total amount that they were paying every year in the private school was $70,000 a year, which gives you a sense of the amount of money that is involved in this.
So Tony, listening to this, so that they didn't feel their student with autism was tailored and challenged in a way that was tailored to him or her. I'm not sure if it was a boy or a girl here. In this idea of being appropriate. So it's not enough for a school to look after to integrate that student, but that person has to have a challenging and opportunity to advance and learn in a different way.
Precisely, Ben. What the parents alleged was that the school district hadn't developed a plan that would promote year-to-year progress for their son. Essentially, the parents said that the school district was providing an education that led to only minimal improvements from year to year, if any at all, for their son. Mm-hmm. What's so interesting is that not only the fact that the Supreme Court agreed with the parents, but the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in favor of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And what the court held was that school districts must draft IEPs that are reasonably calculated to enable the child to make progress appropriate in light of the child's circumstances, and that the IEP must aim to enable the child to make progress. Now, of course, that's still pretty vague, but what the court emphasized was that they want – what the Supreme Court emphasizes that district court judges, when reviewing these types of cases, need to look and see if the IEP that the school has drafted provides for such minimal progress that it appears as though the school is really just sitting idly by waiting until the child is old enough to drop out.
Mm.
And what's another component about this case that's so interesting is it effectively rejected – a ruling by Justice Gorsuch when he heard a similar case while sitting on the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. In that 2008 case, Gorsuch had held that a school district complied with this federal law as long as education it provided to children with disabilities was more than minimal. And what the Supreme Court unanimously said in Andrew is that that's not good enough. The court wants to see a coherent plan to promote year-to-year improvement with regard to every child with disabilities, and that plan has to be tailored to this, the particular circumstances of the individual child.
Interesting. Gorsuch was not on the bench at that point, but in this 8-0 ruling, you could say perhaps he would have been the only dissenter, huh?
Yes, exactly. Although, on the other hand, Gorsuch may well have felt that he was, as an intermediate appellate court judge, he was bound by pre-existing Supreme Court precedent. And indeed, this case did turn on a Supreme Court case from a few years ago with regard to exactly how much progress it required. But it certainly was awkward for Justice Gorsuch to have this ruling handed down in the middle of his confirmation hearings.
Tony Goggin of Drake University's Law School with us this hour, taking us through some of the most significant rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court on this edition of River to River. Todd Pettis along with us from the University of Iowa Law School. Let's go to a ruling by the Supreme Court late last month. Have you explain one that concerned the divide between church and state?
Yeah, the case is called Trinity Lutheran Church versus Comer. It's a case out of Missouri. And just to set up the case, we all know, of course, that in the First Amendment, there's two religion clauses, one that gives us the right to the free exercise of religion, and then another clause, the Establishment Clause, that bars the government from establishing a religion. And just to kind of put a frame around this case, you just think for a second about how those two clauses are in some tension with each other, and that tension drives a lot of the religion cases that the Supreme Court hears. And here's that tension. Suppose the government wants to focus on the Establishment Clause and say, okay, we're not supposed to establish a religion, so we're going to make sure that no government money of any kind, no benefits of any kind are going to religious communities. Well, pretty soon those religious communities feel like they're being singled out for disfavored treatment, because they're religious, and that violates their free exercise rights. Or if the government starts from the other point of view and says, okay, we're really going to be serious and all gung-ho about free exercise, so we're not going to make any distinctions between people when handing out government money, government programs. We don't care whether you're religious or not. Well, that's going to increase the flow of government money to religious communities, and then people are going to say, well, you're establishing a religion because now my tax dollars are going
to – okay,
so this tension drives a lot of cases, and that tension is very much on display in this case, Trinity Lutheran. Missouri wanted to do something with its scrap tires. You know, junk tires are piling up. And so they came up with a program that's funded by a fee they put on the sale of new tires, where they're going to hand out government grants to nonprofits, to people who want to use recycled tires to put a much softer, more forgiving surface down on their playgrounds. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a public school could apply, a YMCA could apply. Trinity Lutheran runs a daycare. And it's open to everybody. They've got 90 kids there. It's not their own parishioners' kids. It's neighborhood kids. But they do run a daycare, and they apply for a grant. And that grant is a great looking – they write it up beautifully. It's one of the highest ranked grants in the program. But then Missouri says, but we have a categorical rule. We're not going to give any money to religious entities because under our state constitution, where we have our own establishment clause – our state constitution's establishment clause goes on at some length. I won't take the time to read it, but it does go on. It's much longer than the text of the First Amendment, emphasizing – Iowa has one of these too, by the way – emphasizing the importance of making sure that taxpayers' money is not flowing to religious communities. And so Missouri had really started from the establishment clause point of view, and then Trinity Lutheran said, well, you're singling us out because we're religious. Okay. You can your listeners can kind of put themselves in the shoes of a Supreme Court justice, because there's kind of a version of this for those of us who are raised on Sesame Street. There's this, you know, one of these things is not like the other. You know, so you put an array of things up, and which one of these things is different?
Right.
There are two main precedents that prior cases the court had decided. The debate was largely about which of these is most similar to these facts, the ones I've just described. So here are the two cases, and they're really simple cases.
Okay.
One's a case from the late 1970s called McDaniel. And in that case, a state, Tennessee, had said that if you're a minister, you cannot serve as a delegate to the state constitutional convention. Okay? You can't help rewrite the Constitution if you're a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the court struck that down and said that's unconstitutional. There's another case called Locke versus Davy from the early 2000s where the state of Washington was handing out scholarships to talented students, and they said, we'll give everyone's eligible for one of these. Even if you're going to a religious college, that's fine. But if your college major is basically ministry preparation, well, we're not going to use these scholarships to actually pay for the training of new ministers. And the court in Locke versus Davy said, that's fine. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now the question is, in Trinity Lutheran, which of these two cases does this look most like?
I'm raising my hand.
You got your hand
in the back,
yes, in the
Mr.
class.
Kiefer. Yes. I want to say it's a Washington State case. Did I? No.
You're going to have company no matter which you choose.
Because it was a benefit to be given and then denied.
It's a financial benefit and it was being withheld. Yeah. Well, that view got Justice Sotomayor's vote, and it got Justice Ginsburg's vote. They said this is Locke versus Davy all over again. Here's a state handing out money and just withholding it in honor of a strong state constitutional commitment against the establishment of religion, which the state of Washington had as well. A majority of the court said, no, this is more like McDaniel, and here's why. You're singling somebody out – here the somebody is a church. You're singling somebody out just because of their status as being a religious person or thing. And Locke versus Davy is different. The Washington scholarship case is different because in that case, what we upheld was Washington saying, we're not going to give you this money because of what you're going to do with it.
Mm.
Okay? We didn't say it's okay. We're not going to give you this money just because of who you are. You're a believer. Your religious community. Well, no money for you. No, you're going to use the money for a religious purpose, basically train for the ministry. Here, Trinity Lutheran is using the money just to put down a surface on its playgrounds to keep the children from being hurt. For the dissenters, Sotomayor and Ginsburg, that was not persuasive. They said, well, you know, we come up with a program to taking the lead paint out of – this is my example, but it's close to what they say – taking the lead paint out of Sunday school room walls or resurfacing the church pews. You know, it looks like the majority is saying taxpayer money now can flow into refurbishing churches, and surely that's not right. One last quick point about this case. Justice Gorsuch participated in this. He wrote a separate little opinion. He was with the majority, saying that this case looked like McDaniel. He wrote a separate opinion joined by only Justice Thomas, and he really signaled here one of the reasons why conservatives were so enthusiastic about his appointment. He said, you know, I'm going to go along with the majority opinion, but I just want to raise the possibility that Locke versus Davey was wrongly decided to begin with. Mm. And that's, of course, one thing you can do if you have enough votes. You can just knock one of the pieces on the board off the table, and then you don't have to deal with distinguishing it anymore.
Especially if you were a Supreme Court
justice.
So,
yeah, and so he raises the possibility that Locke versus Davey never should have been decided the way that it was. And it was a close case. It was 5-4, as I recall.
So the implications going forward of this decision?
Well, they may be broad. There's one little footnote. They drop a footnote, and they say, in this case, we're talking about playgrounds. We're not talking about religious funding and so forth. And that raises a lot of eyebrows. So we don't know what its implications are going to be. There's something about children's safety. Justice Breyer wrote a separate opinion, said, well, this case is about children's safety, and so I'm going to go along with the majority here. So we don't know. It could be a playground case, or it could be turn out to be a very significant case about funding for religious entities.
Okay, Todd Pettis, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Tony Goggin. Tony's going to talk about Travel Ban 2.0. We had a ruling come down last month partially revived the president's travel ban, right, Tony?
That's exactly right, Ben.
Okay, we'll talk about that when we come back. Also, another case that Todd Pettis is going to tell us about that involves this band we're about to hear from Portland, Oregon. They go by the name The Slants. Now, is that a slam to Asians to have a band, The Slants? Deals with the protection of free speech. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Back with Tony Goggin and Todd Pettis. And you can think about, in the meantime, it has to do with the Washington Redskins case as well. We'll talk about it. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
Back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. We love this show that we do periodically, looking at the high court cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Some shows we look at Iowa Supreme Court cases. In this case, it's the nation's high court we're looking at, with Tony Goggin of Drake University's Law School and Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa Law School, walking us through some cases, telling us the stories behind these cases. Really a good hour to find out in particular, in detail, in people's lives, how our court system works, in this case at the highest level. Still to come, we'll talk about a case involving the Asian band named The Slants. Is that disparaging? What does that matter? It ties in with the Redskins as well. Also, we want to talk about the newest justice, Neil Gorsuch, how he's shaping the high court, and whether any of the other justices look likely to retire. Let's talk a little bit, Tony, with you about we heard in our headlines that It's called Travel Ban 2.0, a revised travel ban put forth by the president. The high court's decision to partly revive that travel ban, the court here largely rejecting the lower court's rulings, huh?
That's right. This case arose in late January when President Trump, acting on a campaign promise, issued an executive order suspending entry for 90 days of foreign nationals from seven Mideast countries with predominantly Muslim populations. And President Trump justified the order on the grounds that, in his view, individuals from these countries posed a heightened terrorism risk. He also suspended the U.S. refugee admissions program for 120 days. In response to lawsuits filed by plaintiffs alleging that the orders had violated the Establishment Clause by discriminating against Muslims, a federal court in Washington issued a preliminary injunction blocking enforcement of the executive order. Interestingly, as you indicated, Ben, this is Travel Ban 2.0 for this reason. When Trump lost in the lower courts, the president responded by revoking the order and issuing a new one that dropped Iraq from the travel ban. The U.S. military had strongly objected to including Iraq from the travel ban, in part because there are so many translators who have played such a critical role in supporting U.S. military operations in Iraq at great personal risk to themselves. And mm-hmm. so the military wanted individuals like them to be able to get into the U.S. Well, the president exempted Iraq and exempted legal permanent residents, but he otherwise kept the heart of the original order in place. Another lawsuit was filed, and a preliminary injunction was issued by a federal judge in Hawaii blocking the revised order. Now, the underlying merits of the travel ban will be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court this fall. The immediate issue before the Supreme Court in the case last month was whether to grant the Trump administration's request to stay or suspend the preliminary injunctions until the court gets to hear the full case later this year.
Mm-hmm. And so it just avoided the big questions, pushed them off into the fall. And quickly, what are the big questions that they will still have to tackle?
Well, this case is fundamentally about national security in the intersection of national security law with the Fifth Amendment's Establishment Clause, because historically the president has had sweeping authority to control immigration, particularly on national security grounds. And that is why in the preliminary injunction ruling, the justices did hold that the president or the government's interest in preserving national security is an objective of the highest order, which is why you did have a unanimous court grant in part the president's request for a stay. But the ongoing dispute right now is over the defeat that President Trump had in this ruling last month. The court held that the preliminary injunctions remain in effect for foreign nationals who have a bona fide relationship to the U.S. And what's really interesting is the court identified a close familial relationship to Americans as an example of a bona fide relationship or admission to a U.S. university. But just in the immediate aftermath of that court ruling, the travel ban went into effect on June 29, and the Trump administration announced that the term close familial relationship only applies to parents, children, spouses, and fiancés, not grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, or in-laws. And last week, a Hawaii federal judge rejected the Trump administration's definition of close familial relationship and said, hey, you got to
– if fiancés are there, why can't grandparents be there?
Right. Exactly. And Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in response, condemned the judge and said that he's undermining national security. Nevertheless, last night, the State Department issued new guidelines that accommodated the federal judge's order. So this – there's so many moving parts to this. And I'd add one really – interesting issue in the background, a constitutional issue with regard to the underlying merits, and that's this. When President Trump on January 20th was sworn in as president, he took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And yet during the campaign, he described this travel ban as a Muslim ban. And so one of the issues the Supreme Court's going to have to decide this fall is – do they believe the president took his oath of office seriously, or did that pre-existing expression of a clear intent to target Muslims continue past January 20th, past the president's oath of office? And that's a ruling, whichever way they come out, is going to have long-term ramifications when it comes to whether statements made on a campaign trail are something that courts can look to when determining what the government's intent is when it adopts a policy, particularly in the context of national security.
Okay, we'll wait for the fall. Supreme Court hearing those arguments in the fall and eventually the decision there. Tony Goggin with us, Todd Pettis with us as we look at Supreme Court rulings, latest things in this current session. Time is getting away from us, but I wanted to get to this, Tony, perhaps related to a court case decided by a 4-2 vote that held that a group of non-citizens that were treated a certain way after the 9/11 attacks. So tell us that story.
Yes. This is a very tragic case. It arises from the immediate aftermath of September 11 when, as I'm sure your listeners will recall, there was real fear in the United States that there would be follow-on terrorist attacks. And in response, the Justice Department incarcerated hundreds of people on immigration charges, and these were people of Middle Eastern descent. And these individuals were held in very harsh conditions. In fact, the Inspector General conducted an investigation and concluded the report was very critical of the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Prisons because these people were held essentially like you would hold serial killers. They were held in 23-hour lockdowns. They had heavy restraints on. So they were treated very poorly. And then they were released and deported from the U.S. And they wanted to bring suit alleging that their Fifth Amendment, the right of equal protection, due process had been violated. And the court rejected their claims on the basis of this doctrine called qualified immunity, which essentially says that you can't sue the government without its consent. That's sovereign immunity. And if you're going to sue individual government officials for violating the law, you have to show that the officials should have known that the actions they were taking were in violation of clearly established law. And the court, in an opinion by Justice Kennedy, concluded that there was not enough evidence to support the finding that the government officials should have known they were violating the law at the time that they detained these individuals.
Yeah.
So it was a real setback for the plaintiffs.
And we remember back to that time, post 9/11 and the immediate aftermath, what a feeling we had in this country, nation in panic, and not realizing that thinking all along that we were one sort of secure in one way and then realizing we were not secure at all. So interesting case tying into the immediate aftermath after the 9/11 attacks. Before the break, I mentioned the slants. So we heard a little bit from this Asian band from Portland, Oregon, trademark case involving the slants, which also ties into the case we've heard a lot more about, the Washington Redskins football team. Todd Pettis, take us through that one.
Yeah. Well, if you may sell some music today. I don't know. That was a nice little clip. People want to hear more. They have a website. It's theslants.com. It's not a personal thing. This case has been my introduction to them, but it's kind of a fast techno kind of music. They build themselves as a dance rock band. They're Asian Americans, and they call themselves the Slants, trying to kind of reclaim a derogatory term for Asians and kind of self-appropriating it. And they haven't gone halfway with it. Their albums are called things like the Yellow Album, Something Slanted This Way Comes, Slanted Eyes, Slanted Hearts. It's very much how they bill themselves. Well, they wanted to register their band name as a trademark. So they go to the Patent and Trademark Office and ask to register it. And the PTO, Patent and Trademark Office, declines. Pursuant to this federal law, the same law that I think came up in the Redskins case, which says we're not going to trademark anything that disparages somebody, whether that person is living or dead. And so we could say if the term Redskins is disparaging to Native Americans, then we're not going to allow that trademark. And if Asians are going to find it disparaging, and they would, then we're not going to allow you to trademark it. And what the court said, they divided a couple of opinions, but we won't get lost in the weeds here. All the justices, eight of them, Justice Gorsuch was not there yet, all eight agreed that this was a violation of First Amendment speech rights. And at the core is what may be kind of an alarming proposition to some, but it's a very important First Amendment principle, which is just because speech is offensive to somebody doesn't mean that it can be banned. There are circumstances where offensive speech can be banned, but it's not because it's offensive. It's because the offensiveness is going to lead to something else, like a fight, a breach of the peace. You know, you say this to this person or these circumstances, mm-hmm. the fists are going to start to fly. But absent that, what we're talking about is just kind of just offensiveness. I don't mean to downplay it by saying just offensiveness, but I mean just pure offensiveness. That's not a basis for banning speech. And so if they want to call themselves the Slants, they can call themselves the Slants, and the government has to register it as a trademark.
So does this pinball back to affect the Redskins' decision?
As far as I understand it, it certainly should, because that was the only basis for withholding trademark protection for the Redskins, is it's going to disparage a group of people. And the court came down, again, unanimously in separate sets of opinions. But all justices agreed that singling out speech just because it's saying offensive or derogatory things about somebody, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, a few more cases, two more cases to get through. We want to talk about a couple other things. But before we leave this hour with Todd Pettis and Tony Goggin, our legal experts, walking us through some of the latest and most significant cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Tony, tell us about this case of a sex discrimination case that concerned children born abroad to an unwed U.S. citizen.
Yes, Ben, this is a fascinating case. And in this case involved the issue of when an American parent can automatically confer U.S. citizenship on their children born on foreign soil. As you may recall, the issue came up during the presidential race last year when it was revealed that Texas Senator Ted Cruz was born in Canada in 1970. Now, Cruz's mother was American, and she had spent the first 30 years of her life in the U.S. before moving to Canada. And accordingly, she was able to confer her citizenship on Ted Cruz at his birth by virtue of the fact that she was a U.S. citizen. But what this case concerned was what happens if a parent has only spent a few years in the U.S. before going overseas. And the plaintiff in this case, Morales Santana, was born in the Dominican Republic to an American father in 1962. As it turns out, an important fact was that his father was not married to the plaintiff's mother at the time of the plaintiff's birth. The plaintiff, Morales Santana, then moved to the U.S. at age 14 and lived in the U.S. from the 1970s until the early 2000s, when he ended up running into some trouble with the law. And that caught the attention of immigration officials, who, after investigating his background, attempted to deport him on the grounds that the Morales Santana's father was 18 years old when Morales Santana himself was born. And the catch was, the federal law at the time said that if you are going to pass on your citizenship to your foreign-born children, you need to have spent at least 5 years in the U.S. after turning age 14. And because the father was 18, this was a clear-cut case, which meant Morales Santana was not a U.S. citizen. There was no doubt that the father didn't meet the age requirement, but the issue was the underlying statute itself constitutional? Because there was an interesting detail in the statute, and that was it provided an exception for American citizen mothers who were unwed at the time of their child's birth in foreign soil. They only had to show that they lived in the U.S. for 1 year after turning age 14. And the real irony of this case is the plaintiff argued, hey, this is a clear violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Fifth Amendment, and the Supreme Court agreed. They said, yeah, that's right. This is unconstitutional for this statute to treat the children of unwed mothers differently than the children of unwed fathers. But it was a Pyrrhic victory for the plaintiff, because instead of ruling that the fathers should get the same generous treatment as the mother's children, the court held that children of mothers should get the same ungenerous treatment as children of the fathers. In other words, the one-year exception for mothers was struck down by the court, and the court held that 5-year requirement must apply to children of mother unwed American mothers as well as fathers. And the logic behind – Justice Ginsburg's who wrote the opinion, the logic behind it was looking at the statute, it was clear that the default rule was the 5-year rule and the 1-year rule was just the exception. And so when faced with that posture, the court's policy is to – or the court's approach is to say we go with what we think the congressional intent was, and they concluded that if Congress had to choose, they would have required a 5-year residency period in the U.S. So this was at a very – it was a constitutional victory but a legal defeat for the plaintiff.
Mm-hmm. Less than 5 minutes before we end our discussion here of many fascinating cases this hour. I want to get to the question of Neil Gorsuch here, some of the cases he's been on in the decision, some not. He joined the court mid-session or well into the session. Todd Pettis, I don't know if we have time for any other cases, if you can wrap this into one, but when you look at how Neil Gorsuch has been shaping the court in his argumentation, his decisions, what conclusion do you come to?
I think it's very clear. If he continues the voting pattern that he had just in this short time, this last term, he's going to be one of the court's most conservative members, maybe more so than Justice Alito, who's quite conservative. But there's different ways of kind of putting these justices on an array. Justice Thomas is usually regarded by most measures as the most conservative. And it appears, again, just based on this little bit of evidence, justices do sometimes change once they're there for a while. But just on this little spate of rulings that he participated in now, he's going to be one of the most conservative. I mentioned earlier in the religious freedom case expressing a willingness to overturn one of the court's precedents that he thought was hostile to religious freedom. I won't go into the details of the case. I'll just say its name if anybody wants to Google it. But it's Pavan, P-A-V-A-N versus Smith, having to do with same-sex couples and birth certificates for their children. And in that case, he wrote an opinion that makes it quite clear that on issues of same-sex marriage, same-sex couples' rights, he does not expect much of the government when it comes to explaining why a same-sex couple is going to be treated differently. Mm-hmm. And so he's quite conservative and he's young. I think we talked about that last time we were here. He's going to – if he continues down this path, he's going to be at least as conservative as Justice Scalia probably was, maybe more so.
Only a couple minutes to address the retirement watch this time of year. We're looking for justices, what, telltale signs of possible retirement. Tony, do we see any from any of the justices?
Well, certainly, Ben, there was a lot of speculation last month that Justice Kennedy might announce in the last day of the term his decision to retire. He did not do that. And so the expectation is that he will serve the full term of the 2017-2018 Supreme Court term. But it's clear that certainly the tea leaves are suggesting that Kennedy does not have much interest in spending too much more time on the Supreme Court, which means we very well could have a vacancy in the summer of 2018. I would just add Kennedy's 80 years old, which explains why he might be ready for a break. And as Todd
said –
Well,
he needs to talk to Ruth Bader Ginsburg then, right? In her 90s, right?
That well, she's 84.
84, sorry.
But and Justice Breyer, 78. So those are three justices who potentially could, either for health reasons in the case of Ginsburg or Breyer, because I certainly don't think either would voluntarily step down until the 2020 election to see if whether Donald Trump will be president to the 2020s. But as Todd indicated, there's no doubt Gorsuch is as conservative as Scalia. Kennedy, in contrast, is a moderate conservative, and so his replacement potentially could change the direction of the court, which means if Kennedy steps down, the stakes will be off the charts.
Mm-hmm. So your thoughts, Todd, before we leave, as you look into the future, even looking to 2020 and so forth, whether this current bench of justices will remain so until the 2020 election.
Well, I agree with everything that Tony said and his read on those individual justices. You know, the way the court's going to change is either Justice Kennedy leaves because he's a swing justice, and so no matter who's in the White House, the naming of his replacement is going to be huge, or you have a Republican in the White House when one of the current Democratic appointees like Breyer or Ginsburg steps down, or vice versa. You have a Democrat in the White House when a Republican appointee like Thomas steps down. Those are the things that are really going to throw the court. And, of course, we're going to have a Republican in the White House for the next few years. And Kennedy and Ginsburg are getting up there. Breyer is getting up there. So we could well see a big swing.
We potentially have this precedent that was recently set that in the last year of a president's term, evidently, Obama was denied nominating or having a hearing for his nominee in the last year of his presidency.
Yeah, that precedent is going to go out the window so fast.
Really?
My read of it politically. Yeah. It depends on whose interest it serves. I mean, even with respect to legal precedent, we talked earlier about maybe just overturning a case that you think was wrongly decided. I think, you know, whoever that principle serves is going to invoke it. Whoever the principle does not serve is going to say, oh, it was wrongly conceived to begin with.
Politics and talking out both sides of your mouth? Does that happen?
I hear that it happens, yeah.
Okay. Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa Law School, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation. Tony Coggin, Professor of Law at Drake University's Law School. Tony and Todd, always great to have you on and walk us through the case, the cases before us, learn about them and their implications. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. And our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, Politics Wednesday is on our docket for tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Sure to talk about the Affordable Care Act, its repeal, replacement, its future, and plenty of other things. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.